Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 204. And in the last lesson, we were in chapter 48, at the time when Jacob was passing on the blessings to his sons, the one that he just adopted, the children of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And he basically was saying that they are going to be blessed, and also they are going to be a blessing in the midst of Israel. Israel will be using their names as a blessing. In other words, just like he passed to them such great blessing. Of course, later on, when we come to chapter 49, and then later on when Moses spoke about it, he didn't speak about Ephraim and Manasseh, but he spoke directly about Joseph. But God made it very plain that he wanted Joseph to be not just only one of the brothers and receive his birthright, but he wanted it divided between Ephraim and Manasseh. And that's the reason why Jacob had to go through this adoption ceremony. And I'm sure it's not something that he just concocted in his own brain and came up with this idea. Obviously, God spoke to him and let him know that this is what he wanted. And therefore, what we read here is something that God has inspired him to do. And he knew exactly what he was doing, and obviously he didn't tell Joseph, and Joseph was not aware of what was happening. He expected, you know, when he came, you know, he's going to be blessed. And he finds himself blessed, but at the same time he finds also his children taken away from him and adopted by his father, and the blessings are passed on to them directly. And so Jacob is saying in verse 19, and he's saying to his son Joseph that he knows what he's doing. In essence, you know, his father refused. In other words, refused to do what Joseph wanted him to do, switch hands. And he said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Howbeit his younger brother shall be greater than he. And his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And so that became a blessing for all of Israel. And that was a general blessing that was basically mentioned several times with Rebekah when they sent her away. That's what they told her, you know, may your descendants be a multitude of people. And obviously this is one of the greatest blessings that you can have, a lot of children. And especially in an agrarian society, you can understand it more because you need a lot of workers. And in those days, your workers were your own children. And the more children you had, the more riches you had, the more employees, the more work. And so that was the main thing. And of course, here he's not talking only about the few children that the person has, but he's talking in terms of all of his descendants. They're going to be great in number. There are going to be many, many people, many nations. And so that's what he's saying here. And then that will become a blessing for every child in Israel. When a father, when a grandfather wants to bless, you know, their children, their grandchildren, they're going to invoke this blessing that was placed upon Ephraim and Manasseh. And so he's saying here, and he blessed them, that they saying, by you shall all Israel, that is, shall Israel, speaking about all the tribes of Israel, obviously not about Manasseh and Ephraim, because those in Manasseh and Ephraim don't need to repeat that. And so here he makes very plain, you know, for those people that think that he gave, you know, his name to Israel, to these two, he made it very plain, he didn't. All of Israel are still Israel, and so Israel is going to be saying, when they bless their children, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And as Manasseh, and he set Ephraim before Manasseh. As was mentioned in the last lesson, you know, to this very day, there are grandparents and there are parents that bless their children. And oftentimes when they come to visit or on different occasions, with this blessing, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And obviously they're not aware of the identity of Manasseh. Manasseh and Ephraim are not aware of their own identity, and they're not doing it. And yet Judah is the only one that preserved this blessing to this very day. And so ironically, when you think about what Jacob is saying, in you Israel shall bless, the only Israel that blesses to this very day with this blessing, and has been doing it for the last many, many centuries, is the southern house of Israel. In contrast to the northern house of Israel, you see there were two houses of Israel, as you can read in Isaiah 8 and verse 14, I believe. where God speaks through Isaiah about the two houses of Israel who are going to be exposed to the truth about their Savior, but yet both of them are going to stumble. And they still do to this very day. And so Israel, and in specific here, all these many centuries, it was Judah, the house of Judah, a national name, but also Israel, that invoked this blessing and still do to this very day. And so Israel said unto Joseph, behold, I die, but God will be with you and bring you back unto the land of your fathers. Now Joseph himself was not going to be brought back, but he's talking about it prophetically, because God told him when he went down to Egypt, God said, I'll come down to Egypt with you also. And he certainly made his presence very known in the house of Pharaoh, among the people of Israel, and even in the days of Joseph in the beginning, he already made them in essence rulers of Egypt along with their brother. And all the cattle and riches of Egypt, you know, ended in their hands because they were managing it for Pharaoh. And certainly God was with them. But he said also, obviously this is not the end, you know, for you. No more than it is for all the tribes of Israel that went into captivity and later on migrated into other lands that God gave them. And they may think that they are going to be in these lands forever. Well, just like it was in Egypt, no matter how much greatness and blessings and abundance God gave them and how many children he gave them and riches and all those things, it is not their place. God is going to bring them back to their land. That's their headquarters. After that, you know, some of them is a multiply. Obviously, they're going to migrate again to other places, but the headquarters will remain Israel. And so he says, the God that in essence brought us down here and brought you down here is also going to take you back home. And so he will bring you back unto the land of your fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and his own father Jacob. And moreover, I have given you one portion above your brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. And what is he talking about here? Two things. One is the firstborn, according to the law, as you would read later on in Deuteronomy, received two portions. In other words, one extra portion. And some people get the feeling that Joseph received the overwhelming majority of the blessings, and that's what the birthright means, while the rest of the tribes of Israel got just the crowns. Well, that's not the law of God. And God obviously did not work it out that way. And people forget when they think about Ephraim and Manasseh. When you talk about Ephraim, they had England, but also there are other brothers of Israel there. There's Levi, and you know, they're part of Judah, in Scotland, in Ireland, and you have the Levites in Wales, and you have also other portions of Israel living in the British Isles also. Not only Jews, but all the tribes of Israel also are represented there. And then when they came to the new lands, to the Americas, you find in the Americas, in essence, ironically, the first one that discovered this territory was the son of Judah, Columbus. A lot of people don't know that Columbus came from a Jewish family that was converted into Catholicism. And he is the first one through whom God, in essence, was opening the door for the children of Israel. You know, Judah always goes first. And Judah came first. As it is, our historic records that tell us that in the days of Solomon, the son of Judah, his mariners, you know, his seamen of Dan and Naphtali and Zebulun, and all those tribes were up there in conjunction with the Phoenicians that were of the people of Edom, brother of Jacob. They formed an alliance, obviously, and they had good, you know, good relationship with David and later on with Solomon. And so they navigated, you know, circumnavigated the world, and they came to the lands that later on God was going to give to his people Israel. And so they ended up also among other places beside the British Isles, also here in the Americas. And there are inscriptions to this very day that testify to that. They're written in both Hebrew and Phoenician. And so you see Judah, you know, making it first here, and then later on, the children of Ephraim and Manasseh came over here to this land, and they were established here because that was going to be given to them primarily, obviously. But also, as time went by, all the other tribes of Israel joined them. You see? In other words, people from all the tribes of Israel also came over here. Not that all of them came over here. And so this land of America became the land of Israel, not the land of Joseph only. You see? So Joseph, after all, did not get this whole territory only for himself, or Manasseh's, or Ephraim. You see, you find Ephraim in, a lot of Ephraim in British Canada, and then you find Reuben also there, you know, in other parts of Canada, and you know, the Quebec area and that whole territory, and many other places, and even here, the Louisiana Purchase was owned by Reuben, and then was sold obviously to Manasseh. But the reality is, you know, there are a lot of the people of Reuben there in the south. They're different than the people of the north. And then you have all the tribes of Israel heavily represented in this country. So you don't see Manasseh here getting the whole thing. And, you know, that would explain to you, you know, the law of the birthright that people misunderstood. And, yes, Joseph received an awful lot, but he's to share it with his brethren. So he's not receiving it only for himself. And all the other brothers also received their own portions in, you know, Northwest Europe and other places. And so that's what you see here. Joseph is receiving one extra portion, and that basically was the law of the birthright. Only one extra portion to the older son, because he's going to be responsible and he's going to assume sort of you know, being the head of the family while the father is alive to a degree, and then mostly after the father is gone, then he becomes literally the head of the family. And so obviously he needs that extra portion for that, you know, and he's rewarded with that. And so this is what you see here, one extra portion given to him. And Jacob also mentions the fact that the extra portion that he's going to give him is going to be, in essence, on the east bank. That's where the Amorites were. And so when they came to the land, you see Ephraim receiving his portion, and Manasseh being the firstborn. See, it's not Ephraim that received the two portions, it's actually Manasseh that received the two portions. And so there was Ephraim and Manasseh, but Manasseh in particular, though he had one half of his tribe with the rest of the tribes of Israel, one half on the other half of his tribe, and that had a much larger territory, was on the east bank in the land of the Amorite, that Jacob and his sons went to war and conquered it from the Amorites. And of course that's not even mentioned in the scriptures. And yet here Jacob is revealing something that was not known prior to that. That his life was not just a life of peace, where he was just a shepherd. He literally went to war. And so this is what he's saying here, that he went to war against the Amorites in that territory, because obviously the land of Israel, where he was there, or Canaan at the time, it was not big enough for him. It was mostly populated. So he had to go to the east bank even at that time. Because he had an awful lot of flocks. And obviously he was not about to displace his uncle, so to speak, Uncle Lot, and his children, you know, the Moabites and the Ammonites, because that was given to them. And so he made war with the Amorites. And then later on, Moses, again, makes war with those very people, because, you know, once Jacob made war with the Amorites and conquered this territory, he went down to Egypt. And so the Amorites moved back in. And then Moses had to go in and do the same thing all over again. And he displaced them. And so you see two conquests from that area. And it's very interesting, because in the future that's going to happen again. In the days of Joshua, they conquered the land of Canaan. And then later on, God brought back his people, the end time also, to conquer the entirety of the land. And basically the people that went there are the people of Judah, and mainly Levi with them, Benjamin, and some of the sprinklings of Israel that joined the house of Judah in the past. And that's what you find there. But then again, there is going to be the ultimate conquest when, in Isaiah 11, you read about that, when the house of Judah and the house of Joseph are going to be on the march again. And it is made very plain. They're going to conquer this whole territory there, you know, the territory of their own land, the territory of the Gaza area, of the Philistines. They're going to basically obliterate all these people, and they're going to obliterate everybody in the West Bank, you know, except the exception of the few that are going to give in and submit to the will of God and be willing to live in peace with the children of Israel. And in Ezekiel, you read about the strangers that God is going to allow to remain in the land. And also, they're going to subjugate Ammon and Moab, that means Jordan, and they're going to conquer again, all over again, you know, the East Bank, and Syria, and Lebanon, and all the way to the Euphrates. God is going to put again the house of Joseph and the house of Judah, which means, in essence, the 12 tribes, and they're going to conquer their land just like in the days of Joshua. And so in this statement that you read here, you have a prophetic meaning here for many times to come in the future. And that's what he's saying here. He said, I'm giving you the portion above your brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. And this is the first time you read about it. And then we continue now to a second portion of this blessing. At this point, he's calling all of his sons, not just Joseph and his sons, but all of them now appear before him, and we don't know how long that was in between. And so we read here in chapter 49, verse 1, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together. And it could have been, you know, immediately after that, because when Joseph heard that his father was sick, obviously all the rest of the brothers heard too, and all of them, mind you, at this time were in the service of Pharaoh. So they were busy people, rulers of Egypt in essence, rulers of the riches of Egypt, and they were occupied. But Jacob sent obviously a message, and he brought all of them also after he dealt with Joseph. And this time he's going to speak to all of them together. And so we read here, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the end of days. Now mind you, when he passes the blessings to his son Joseph, he's not speaking about the end days. He's speaking, in essence, about later time, which was when Israel came out of Egypt, and then the promises were given to all the children of Israel. And obviously Joseph received his portion there, also in the land of the Amorite. But here he's speaking something about a specific time, not only about the coming to the land, but he's putting the emphasis on the end time. That's the way God meant for it to be, because to begin with, God already knew that he's going to disperse them among the nations. He knew what they're going to be, as he told Moses, you know, write this song and tell the children of Israel, because I know after your death what they're going to do. They're going to rebel against you, and he was going to punish them and disperse them among all the nations. So obviously God knows the whole plan, and he knew that was going to, you know, where, you know, all of them are going to end up in their future lands throughout the world, not only in Northwest Europe and later on in the New World in the Americas. That's the Western branch of Israel, which is the overwhelming majority. But the Eastern branch of Israel, that many people are not aware of, they don't think as much, beside the house of Judah, they were scattered throughout the Middle East, and also Russia and Europe and America and other places, but also the part of Israel that went to the Eastern countries above the area where they used to be in captivity, the Euphrates. So they went to places today like Iran and Kazakhstan, you know, Uzbekistan and Pakistan, Afghanistan. You find them in many of those areas, and they are still there to this very day, and many of them are fully aware of their identity. They even know their own tribes. There are people there who are calling themselves Manassite, and some are Ephraimites, and some from Zebulun and other tribes. And they had, you know, good lands. Many of them have very fertile and good lands that God blessed them with. And ironically, all of them are still living the old life. In other words, they're shepherds, they're farmers, most of them. You know, in those areas, they have not reached the blessings of the Western world, of the developed countries. And so they are, in one way, closer to their forefathers the way they used to be. And some of them, obviously, with whatever modernization they had in their own countries, they have that too. And so they were all over the place, and in essence, this is what Jacob is talking about. After their dispersion, and then later on the blessing that we're going to receive, and the ultimate blessings at the end time. And this is what he's talking about, and obviously that becomes more specific to our end time, and mostly for the Western part of the tribes of Israel, which are the majority in Northwest Europe and the Americas and other places. And so this is what he's saying here. Let me tell you about the end time. Be'achrit hayamim. This is the terminology. And when you read this terminology prophetically throughout the Bible, for example, when you go to Isaiah and chapter 2, and then you read it in other places, in the prophets, this terminology is used for the time when Jesus Christ, when the Messiah, when the Savior will be on this earth, will reign on this earth at his coming. So that's a very specific time. Not only the general terminology of the end of, of days, but the real end of days, which is in essence the last 1,000 years. But here Jacob is speaking about the period of time that is preceding that, but also considered to be a part of the end time. Messianic times, as they call it in the Jewish community, and for them they basically consider the last 2,000 years messianic times, because you know there were messianic expectations. And 2,000 years ago, that's in essence what happened. You know, the Messiah came. But that was not the time for the blessings to be given to his people. You know, spiritual blessings, yes, but not the physical ones. And so in specific, it's the last, you know, century or two. And in a more specific way, the coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom. And so what he's talking about here is mostly prior to the coming of Christ into that period of time also. And so he says to his sons, assemble yourselves and hear, your sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel, your father. And in Hebrew you generally find this kind of poetic rhyming of the statements. Yeah, they are repeated twice in different ways. They are called Jacob and they are called Israel. And you're going to see it throughout all the prophets that way. And so he says, he begins with the firstborn. He's not beginning with Joseph, because Joseph is not the firstborn. He's beginning with Reuben. He says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the first fruits of my strength. And the word you know that he uses here, Bechori, that's from that comes the word the birthright. So you are in essence one that should have had the birthright. You're the firstborn. You're my birthright, in essence. My firstborn should have received everything. And yet, things didn't turn out to be that way. He said, you are the excellency of dignity. In other words, sort of the kingdom that should have been yours. And you have, you know, these qualities also. And the excellency of power. And Reuben, to this very day, you know, typifies a lot of these qualities. You know, you see their art. You see their glorious architecture that you find there. The palaces. You see the great appreciation on the part of Reuben, and that's why many of the tribes of Israel copied that excellency, that artistic nature of Reuben, and many, many good qualities that he had. You know, even the language is a very dignified language that he has, and architecture, buildings, men, or many things like that. He's excelling in many ways. If not for the one major problem that he has in the floor, for which he lost everything else. And so he's the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Yet, in spite of all these things, which are magnificent qualities, that should have earned him three things. One is the birthright, you see, and then, you know, all the physical blessings. The second, you know, the kingdom. You know, the scepter should have come from him. And the third one, the priesthood, you see. But instead of that, God divided it among basically three tribes. He gave the birthright to Joseph, and then he took the kingdom and gave it to Judah, and the priesthood he gave to Levi. And Reuben, well, he was out of all this, and obviously that created problems for him in future generations, and a lot of bad feelings. And in the history, when you study the history of both Ephraim and Reuben, they've had a lot of conflicts between them. Love-hate relationships, so to speak. And so he said, with all those magnificent qualities that you had and all that you were able to receive and you could have received, you are unstable as water. And later on you will read the words of Jesus Christ. He said that a person that follows him and turns away, you know, a person who is unstable as water, cannot make up his mind and go all the way. He says, my soul shall abhor him, and I shall have nothing to do with him. So we cannot put our hand to the ox, so to speak, to the plow, and start working, and then, you know, midway, just give up. And that was a major flaw, and he still has it to this very day. He's unstable as water. Pachaz kamaim in Hebrew, which means a person that you never know which direction he's going to go. No stability there. Capricious. And many of his actions are that way. He's controlled by his emotions, and his mind is not in charge. A man who is controlled by his passions. And people like that, God, you know, obviously, has to work with to give them a backbone, a character, so they can be stable. But in the meantime, he cannot be the firstborn. He cannot bear that quality. And he cannot be not only receiving all those great blessings in terms of the birthright, the physical things, but he cannot be the king. You know, if your king is unstable as water, you see, it's going to be a lot of problems for the nation. And he certainly cannot be the priest. And so he took those qualities and gave them to people, to the sons that had those qualities. Real king quality, like in David, and real priest quality, like in Levi. And so he said, because of that, you're unstable as water, have not you the excellency, because you went up to your father's bed. You say, what kind of a son would do that? Person who is controlled by his own passions and emotions. You know, he's not looking on his father's wife. So his father's wife is looking on her as a woman. See, an object. And a person begins to think that way, and unfortunately too many men think that way when they're, you know, when they are given to their own passions, their own feelings and emotions, and they forget about the head. You know, that should tell them, hey, that's not right. You see? And the, you know, the mind, you know, should the head should educate the heart. And the heart obviously should have the proper input also into the head, so the head does not become just, you know, a purely intellectual. But the head should ultimately be in charge. And Judah had more of these qualities, where sometimes, you know, he could bridle his own passions and emotions and feelings and be on top. And, you know, this is what it takes to be a king. You know, he may have the same passions and the same emotions and feelings as Reuben, but he has also the control that comes from the head and gives him this ability to be the king and overcome regardless. That's why he's called a lion, you see. And the lion is that way. The lion overcomes, and he's the king of all the beasts. And so Judah became the king of all of Israel. And ultimately, you know, the king of kings that comes from him. And when you think about it, you know, even his own descendants, as later on became the apostles of Jesus Christ, they were to rule over all the tribes of Israel. In other words, when the tribes of Israel, including Joseph, when they go back to the land, their kings are not going to be of their own. Their kings are all going to be of Judah, the disciples of Jesus Christ. Reuben was not that kind of a person. And that's a lesson for all of us. And Christ made it very plain. He does not want, in essence, the spirit of Reuben in any one of us in this area. You know, the other areas are wonderful, what he has. But in this area, which is very important, he wants people who are stable. That when they set their eyes and fasten their eyes on God and on the commission and the task that they are given, they should be governed by their mind ultimately, you see, and endure until the end. And so, unfortunately, this is what Reuben had. As a flaw, and that cost him an awful lot. And so, he said, you went up to your father's bed. Then defiled you it, and then we read, he went up to my couch. In other words, what you see here, basically, he's talking to Reuben, he's looking, you know, he's obviously he doesn't have his eyesight, and so he's not really looking at him, you know, fastening his eyes on him, but he's looking in his direction. But then he turns around to the other brothers, and he's saying to them, he went up to my couch. And you can imagine the humiliation that Reuben suffered from that. This time, and the brothers never forgot that. And he never forgot that. And then in verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brethren. In other words, they are always together, but unfortunately into mischief at times. Weapons of violence, their kinship. And he's not talking about only what happened in the days of old, you know, when they were in the land of Canaan, they, you know, these two organized that raid on the city of Shechem and basically and butchered all of them, you know, in their moment of weakness. But he's talking about their nature in general. They had these kind of qualities, and oftentimes they gravitated to each other because of that. And even when you look into their future, when God, you know, through Jacob said he's going to disperse them among all the tribes of Israel, you oftentimes find these people together. You find them here in the south, children of Levi and children of Simeon. You know, that's what makes those rednecks. And you find them in obviously in Judah, heavily in Judah, and you find them among all the tribes of Israel. And later on, when you study the history of Israel and their the emblems that they used, you find the emblems of both Simeon and Levi scattered throughout all the tribes of Israel. And then when you look at the population and you look at those traits, you find them in many places. And those who studied history in a very methodic manner, you know, about all these matters, and I have a lot of this information too. I even wrote a book about this subject that includes many other areas also. And there you can see a lot of this information of Simeon and Levi sprinkled all over the tribes of Israel, and they're very good in the armed forces. You know, they are oftentimes the generals, the pioneers in many armies of Israel, be it in Judah, be it in all the nations of Israel. And certainly the generals of the south were very good generals, men of war, and they still are to this very day in many ways. And so he says in verse 6, let not my soul come into their counsel. You know, because you go over there, you have trouble. In other words, if you do not want to be a man of wrath and a man of violence, you know, just keep away from them. And unto their assembly let my glory not be united. Why? For in their anger they slew a man. You know, in other words, well, in the man in Hebrew, he's in the singular, but in English it's obviously that's what it means. He's speaking specific about the people of Shechem. But also that's their nature, and they continue to be that way. And so in their anger, see, they were, you know, they allowed their anger to control them in essence, and in their self-will they howed oxen. In other words, the terminology that is used for this, for the oxen, is when you want to neutralize the oxen, you know, you cut in certain parts, you know, of their body, of the sinews, and that neutralizes them and makes it easier for you. And that's in essence what those experts in the arena, you know, in the matadors, they call them in Spain, you know, they fight the bulls. That's what they do. They go for the sinews of the ox to sort of weaken them, neutralize them, and then they finally deliver the coup de grace and they kill them. Well, this is what he's saying about Levi and Simeon. You know, they were real good at war, and they in essence even loved it. And in essence he says, you know, these people are vindictive. And as I said, you know, you find many of them in the south and many other parts of the world. You know, these are people that you, when you are with them, you better be a good friend with them and never ever double cross them. You see? Because if you do, trouble is there. They're vindictive, they're vengeful. You see, you all hear about the story about the McCoys and the Hatfields in those areas, you see. That vindictiveness goes on and on and on and on. That anger, that self-will, and you want to be on their good side, you know. Never double-cross them. Be nice to them, always. And this is what these two were. But obviously, God also used his qualities later on, especially in Levi, to use these very qualities to make him the guardian of the faith, the zealous guardian of the faith of Israel. And he demonstrated that, you know, very ably, you know, when Moses, after the golden calf, said, who is unto the Lord, let him come unto me. And guess who came? Tribe of Levi. And he set them, you know, to the task of killing their own brothers, or the children of Israel that rebelled against God. And so that's what happened then. Oh, that was an equality of Levi that was used properly, or Phinehas later on, the same thing. So it could be used rightly or wrongly, all depends what you put it to use for. In verse 7, he said, "Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel." That's what I'm saying, you know, when you know people like that, you better be on their good side, you know, never double-cross them, because you're going to be in real trouble otherwise. And he said, "Because of that, I will divide them." In essence, God is the one speaking through Jacob. He said, "I will divide them," meaning that God will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And that's in essence what happened later on. It didn't happen initially. So you know that this was not, well, Levi was scattered because he was a servant of Israel. But this is not the scattering that we're talking about, Jacob. And Simeon certainly was not. Simeon, you know, had his own territory in the area of the Negev, the south, next to Judah. And so he was not scattered. But later on, God said he was going to scatter these two people among all the tribes of Israel. And this happened in the end time, mostly. In verse 9, now he switches to Judah. So he's going through the sons. In other words, he's going through firstborn, then, you know, Simeon and Levi, and after that, Judah, according to the manner of their birth. And so in verse 9, he says, "Judah is the lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up?" Now, these are qualities that were in Judah. And these are the reasons, and you find many others, why God chose Judah to be the scepter tribe. With all the problems that Judah has, he has many qualities that if he submits to the will of God, he basically resembles the very nature and mind of God and of Jesus Christ. And that's why Jesus Christ, you know, became known as the Lion of Judah. You know, he was not the unicorn of Joseph, or the donkey of Issachar, you know, but the Lion of Judah. So many of those qualities were the very, you know, qualities of the Father himself and of Jesus Christ, and he chose him for that role. And of course he has his own weaknesses too, like everybody else. And so he said, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." Now there is an awful lot of history about it, and that was known in the ancient world. Everybody knew, even from the land of Canaan, that Judah is going to be the royal son. And as time went by, obviously, he was known even more. And that by itself created good things and bad things. You know, one of the bad things that it created is created an envy and animosity between Judah and Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And you could see that rivalry beginning from Egypt. You know, the children of Joseph thought, you know, they deserve everything because they got the birthright. And so Judah receiving the scepter, and they did not, they received the birthright. And so they were sort of vying over control over the nation of Israel. And then later on, you know, the division of the two kingdoms, of the two kingdoms of Israel, to the north and south, house of Israel and house of Judah, was a result of that too. And for future generations to come and to this very day. And yet, whether they like it or not, God meant for it to be this way, that Judah will have the scepter. And then later on he told David that he will always have a king reigning, not only over Judah, but over the house of Israel. And God brought it to pass, because all the kings, the royalties of Europe, and many of the presidents in this country are of the house of Judah, of David. And he had the scepter. And ultimately, all of Israel, as they come back to their land, as I mentioned earlier, are going to be ruled, every single one of them, by a king who is going to be a Jew, a disciple of Jesus Christ, an apostle. And over them, in essence, King of Kings, but still under the King of Kings, and that is David. He's going to rule over all of Israel, and he's going to have 12 kings under him, and he's going to be ruled, obviously, by the King of Kings over all. And this is what it is. That's one reason why Haile Selassie, you know, the former emperor of Ethiopia, having a relationship to David from Solomon, and the Queen of Sheba, he took upon himself this title also, the Lion of Judah, and also the King of Kings. Because this is what Judah was, King of Kings. And so he says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." And that's a biblical terminology of one of his children. That's where children come from, you know, biologically speaking. And as long as men come to Shiloh, well, this is in the Hebrew here, that is in the Bible that I'm using here, that is right in the synagogue, they put as long as men come to Shiloh, which is not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it says until Shiloh comes. But obviously, you know, you see the bias here of the commentator here, because of the Jewish understanding, instead of realizing that the Messiah is coming, you know, they thought about something else. Anyway, so they changed it to as long as men come to Shiloh. This is what it meant. It says until he comes to Shiloh. Until who? You see? The ruler. The ultimate ruler. That later on the prophets understood and the apostles understood is the Messiah. And this one, obviously, writing this, is a Jewish rabbi, and he does not understand that, so he's changing the meaning here. This was basically the former chief rabbi of Great Britain in the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th. And so God says, until Shiloh comes, until the Messiah comes, there is going to be a ruler out of Judah to reign over the house of Israel, all over the place. And so even when you look at the emblems of Judah in the European countries, you see there also the emblem of Judah of the lion. In other words, there are also Jews there, and you know, many prime ministers and kings, obviously, that rule over the tribes of Israel without even their knowledge. And this is what he says about him. And until Shiloh comes, and unto him shall the obedience of the people be. That's the Messiah. So, you know, in the old world, you know, the ancient world, he was known as the royal son, of whom shall, you know, the star shall come, the ruler of humanity, the king of kings. And many societies, many nations at the time, you know, had begun to develop some kind of mythological understanding of that. And according to one of the ancient historians of the world, Sancho Llamas, who was a Phoenician, in other words, an Edomite, he was saying basically that even at the time his own people were worshipping this Judah, and they called him Zeus, and his father they called Jupiter. And this knowledge traveled with the tribe of Dan as they went to the Greek islands, and they brought that mythology over there, and that's why you find it in Greece. You know, some people don't realize that, where it really came from. And Zeus was, you know, the god of gods, and Judah, they knew, is going to be the king of kings, and that's the reason why they called him Zeus. And he continues to speak of him. Unto him shall the obedience of the people be, binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his vesture in the blood of grapes. And you don't understand that until you come to Isaiah 63, the description of Jesus Christ, of the Messiah, the King of Kings, of the line of tribe of Judah, who comes with his vesture dipped with blood, you know, like wine. And that's what the prophet is asking him, and you can go to that one and read it. As a matter of fact, let's do it right now in chapter 63, speaking about the end time and the ultimate destruction that God is going to bring upon Edom, and we mentioned that earlier in the series about Edom. And this is what this person that will come out of Judah, the ruler, and this is what Jacob, in essence, under inspiration by Jesus Christ himself, is saying, that speaking about Jesus Christ himself. He's not speaking about Judah only. Judah also is going to be a part of it. He's going to be used also in this final battle against Edom, against Babylon, and the two of them are linked biblically. And so in Isaiah 63, we read, who is this who comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bosra? That's the ancient capital of Edom. Today you find it in Iraq, the oil capital of Iraq and the Persian Gulf. This one who is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. And so the prophet now is asking, why is your apparel red and your garments like one who trades in the winepress? And he replies, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. For I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my robes. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. And I looked out, there was no one to help, because Christ is the one ultimately is going to bring the ultimate deliverance, and obviously nobody's going to be with him. His own people are at that time downtrodden, they're in captivity. And so he's saying that, I looked out and there was no one to help. And yet, we read in Zechariah 14 that when he comes down, we read there, Judah also shall fight. You see? So the line of Judah is going to be the only one there to fight. At that point, and the later on in Isaiah 11, we read about Judah and the house of Joseph also doing the fighting. But the moment of the coming of the line of Judah, only Judah, who is also the lion, is going to be fighting there and battling the enemies are going to surround Jerusalem. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.